FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. We have a terrific show for you. We're going to be talking this hour with the Oscar-winning director, documentary filmmaker Alex Gibney, talking about his new film, Casino, Jack, and the United States of Money. Quite appropriate for the issues we're dealing with on this program on a regular basis. It's going to be a pleasure to have him. So sit back, relax, enjoy the show today on WILL, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
An international treaty being hammered out behind closed doors could impose strict copyright regulations pushed by the entertainment industry that would make internet service providers the police for copyright infringement. The purported goal of the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, or ACTA, is to stop the proliferation of counterfeit goods around the world. But ACTA also includes several measures that deal with copyright, which have no relationship to counterfeiting and could negatively impact internet users. Sherwin C., Deputy Legal Director for Public Knowledge, explains the difference between the two.
Copyright infringement is when somebody is reproducing or publicly performing a copyrighted work without either the permission of the author or the permission of the law. That's very different from a counterfeit, which is where you have something pretending to be something else, a fake luxury good or a fake pharmaceutical. Basically, you have to have something passing itself off as something that it's not, and violating a trademark. So it's not just an IP violation.
The lack of transparency regarding the contents and decision-making process for ACTA has consumer and privacy advocates very concerned. Measures included in the current draft of ACTA would include statutory damages, among other things.
No matter how much damage is suffered by the copyright holder, they get an automatic amount of money. So if I download a file that's infringing copyright and that's worth a buck on iTunes, they can still sue me and get anywhere from $750 to $30,000.
C agrees that we need good counterfeiting agreements and laws. But the portion of ACTA that deals with copyright interprets our copyright laws in ways that haven't been tested in Congress or the courts. The copyright measures are too broadly written, C says, and that can hurt consumers in the long run.
So many people can infringe copyright without even realizing it. There can be so many more gray areas. VCRs were thought to be copyright infringing until the Supreme Court said otherwise. People were saying the same things about music lockers. You know, some people still aren't willing to admit that it should be legal for people to rip music from a CD that they have themselves bought onto their own iPod. I would like to think that things that progress just a little bit beyond that, and format shifting, having an online storage locker, those things shouldn't be threatened by the extreme risk of liability just because somebody disagrees about policy.
For more information on ACTA, go to publicknowledge.org.
AT&T announced this week that it will no longer offer an unlimited mobile data plan, opting for a tiered system that could leave consumers paying stiff penalties if they go over their limits. AT&T, which has been criticized for the performance of its mobile network, insists that few users are likely to reach the new limits, claiming that 65% currently use less than the lower 200 megabyte cap, and 98% currently use less than the higher 2 gigabyte cap. But consumer and public interest organizations are questioning the move, concerned that the company will not increase the data limits in the future as those thresholds are being met by more and more users. The biggest concern is that, as Chris Riley of Free Press put it, today's heavy user is tomorrow's average user. And with AT&T making the first move, Verizon, Sprint, and T-Mobile are all expected to follow suit in the coming months. Ars Technica reports this week that the U.S. Copyright Group, a law firm based in Virginia, appears to be the main contributor to a dramatic increase in alleged copyright violations in peer-to-peer file-sharing lawsuits against individuals in 2010. The firm works with independent filmmakers and production companies to sue individuals on their behalf at no charge. The individuals are then subpoenaed, their identities revealed by their internet service providers, and then notified by the firm that for a mere $1,500 to $2,500, they can make a lawsuit go away. The settlement is then split between the firm and the filmmaker. 14,583 people have been sued to date, with most of those suits being filed in the last 3 months. Even after years of suing individuals over file sharing, the Recording Industry Association of America went after a total of only 1,800 people. And if the RIAA's campaign serves as any indicator of what is to come, most of the individuals sued by the U.S. Copyright Group will likely pay up and settle instead of going to court.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 this Sunday, June 6, 2010. Our guest today is Alex Gibney, the filmmaker and Oscar-winning director of the film Taxi to the Dark Side, also made the film Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, and a number of other terrific films. We're here today with Alex to discuss his new film, which I just had the privilege of previewing, Casino Jack and the United States of Money. Alex Gibney, welcome back to Media Matters.
Hey, Bob. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you here. And I very much enjoyed watching the film. Thank you very much for making it.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about the film, for starters. You know, why, of all the things you do in your corpus of your work, includes a broad range of issues that you've dealt with, including Henry Kissinger, the electric car, the war in Iraq, obviously, Hunter Thompson. You're working on stuff about Lance Armstrong and Elliot Spitzer. Why Jack Abramoff and the United States of Money?
Well, I guess there's two reasons. I mean, one thing is I should say that when I take on a movie, I usually don't do it just for the issue. There has to be some story that's compelling. And the story of Jack Abramoff is just outrageous. I mean, he's kind of a larger-than-life, almost sort of secret agent character. And he was known as a lobbyist in Washington, the kind of guy that, you know, goes to congressmen and senators on behalf of corporate clients. But he turned that into a kind of grand spy mission, and that was what was interesting about it to me. But I think the other thing about this story in particular that was interesting was that if you really look hard at the Jack Abramoff story, you come to the root of what is, I think, the biggest problem with American democracy right now, and that is it's ruled by money, because it takes tremendous amount of money to get elected now. And so how do people get elected? They go to the people who have the most money, notably big corporations. And so the voice of the people is usually extinguished in favor of the voice of those who have the most money. And I think it makes it almost impossible now to get good decisions made in Washington. You know, we're all very cynical about Washington, but this is the reason why.
Alex Gibney, just briefly before we go into any detail on the film, I suspect we have a handful of listeners who may not really know anything about Jack Abramoff or the scandal, or they've forgotten about it. Could you just, in a thumbnail, just give us a brief description of, you know, who this guy was and what the scandal was that's associated with his name?
Jack Abramoff was a lobbyist, and a lobbyist is a guy who basically goes to Washington on behalf of various people. And actually, there's nothing really wrong with lobbying. You know, it's efficient. You need a lobbyist to cut down the number of people really that would otherwise be waiting outside a congressman or senator's office online. But what Jack Abramoff did was to basically put in motion a kind of confidence scheme with a member of Congress who was very powerful at the time, a guy named Tom DeLay. And basically, what happened was Tom DeLay said, "Okay, Jack, you go out and you market your access to me in exchange for money." And that's okay. So the word was, if you wanted to talk to Tom DeLay, if you wanted to influence Tom DeLay, you had to go through Jack Abramoff, and you had to give Jack Abramoff a lot of money. And that set in motion a kind of legalized and sometimes illegal bribery scheme that ultimately ended up putting Jack Abramoff in jail, along with another Republican congressman named Bob Ney, and tarnished the reputations of a lot of other congresspeople and senators. So that was the essence of the story, but it goes way, way, way beyond that.
As it does, I mean, you go through in the film, and we should just add for listeners, Tom DeLay, during the relevant period, was second in command of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives, and the Republicans were in power in the House during this period. So he was, as you said, extraordinarily powerful.
That's right. And there were a lot of people, and Jack Abramoff was also very good at taking advantage of people who had notoriously been givers to the Democratic Party and didn't have really any way in or access to the Republican Party when the Republican Party took power in 1994. So Jack was able to be the go-to guy for a price to curry favor in the Republican ranks. And he also had very good contacts with Karl Rove, George W. Bush, and many, many others at the top end of the Republican Party.
You know, one of the things that was striking in the film, Alex Gibney, and that evoked a book by Tom Frank, who's one of your experts, called The Wrecking Crew, and Tom was on our show a couple of years ago talking about that book, which also discusses Abramoff, and in which you go through in great detail in the film, is the sort of Abramoff's role in the sort of right-wing college Republican movement of the early 1980s that gave us people like Ralph Reed. And, you know, I think that what comes through in the film, and I want you to talk about this, is the relationship between what on one hand is held up as extraordinarily principled political involvement with the simultaneously extraordinarily corrupt political behavior.
Well, I think it evolves into that, and it evolved into that for two reasons. I mean, one interesting thing about Jack Abramoff was he was, as a young college kid, he was a zealot. He was a conservative zealot. He believed strongly that the market should rule, that there should be as little regulation as possible, and he was virulently anti-Soviet. And he and his pal Grover Norquist, and also his very good friend Ralph Reed, were kind of like the unholy trinity, who plotted and planned that one day they would take control of the Republican Party, and I suppose in a certain sense they did that. But what's interesting about them is that when they do get to the seat of power, their free market ideology morphs into a kind of law of the jungle corruption that means that you can buy and sell anything, and therefore you can buy and sell congresspeople and senators like sneakers. Well, I can't believe that's what the framers had in mind, but that is, in fact, what goes on here. And you have somebody like Ralph Reed, who peddles himself and his reputation as a very devout and holy man. And basically what he did was he would mobilize on behalf of Jack Abramoff anti-gambling religious forces to try to shut down casinos. What he didn't tell anybody was that he was being paid by rival casinos, sometimes millions of dollars, in order to do that holy work. So the work was holy, but the paycheck was unholy.
Well, yeah, your discussion of Ralph Reed in particular, I'm glad you mentioned that, was really eye-opening to me, because I think, like many Americans, and I suspect many of our listeners, my initial exposure to him was connected to Christian Coalition and the Christian right and that type of politics. And, you know, people who didn't like Ralph Reed didn't like him because they thought he was so overly pious and that he was trying to inject his hard Christian right-wing sort of view on how people should behave on everyone else. And then to watch your documentary, Ralph Reed's Christianity, frankly, comes across as opportunism.
It's more, I'd say that's a euphemism. I mean, I think it comes across as just as baldly corrupt.
Yeah.
He uses his religion in order to be able to enrich himself. And he enriches himself by perverting the very values he claims to espouse.
Our guest today, Alex Gibney, who you're listening to, the Oscar-winning filmmaker, documentarian, here talking about his brand-new film, Casino Jack in the United States of Money, just released. If you'd like to call in to WILL AM 580 with a question or comment for Alex Gibney, the number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Alex, you won the Oscar, I think, what, 2 years ago in 2008? Is that correct?
I think it was for the year 2007, but
okay.
I think I got the award in 2008.
And has that opened doors for you as a filmmaker that were not open before?
Sure. I mean, it can't help but do it. That plus the fact that an earlier film I made, you know, Enron,
mm-hmm.
made money. So not only did I
did
a film of mine actually make money, but then
probably the only thing connected with Enron that made money in the last decade.
Exactly, with that and one very famous short seller named Jim Chanos, who actually made an absolute fortune. So that plus the Academy Award really did help me.
And you know, what is the state of documentary filmmaking today? I know you're my age. We went to high school together. So you didn't really burst on the scene as a documentary filmmaker where I became visible with your work until about a decade ago. I think you did the Henry Kissinger film. And I said, wow, that's a guy I knew in high school 30 years ago.
Right.
And, you know, it takes a long time for you to get established, obviously. And, you know, what is your sense of where documentary filmmaking is today for the artist, for the filmmaker, compared to where it was when you broke into the field?
Well, I think one of the really inspiring things is that the old rule book has been thrown out the window. That is to say, the style in which you can approach a documentary now is up for grabs for whatever the artist wants to, for wherever the artist wants to take it, and that's tremendously invigorating. Because for a long time, you know, before I started to hit the mark with theatrical documentaries, I was working a lot in PBS and also in cable television. And cable television, the rules about what kind of documentaries you could make were extremely rigid. You know, they had to conform to the image and style of the channel, and the channel was all, and everything else was just, animal parts to be ground into that particular sausage.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what changed with the rise of the theatrical documentary, which, interestingly enough, did seem to coincide with the with the election of George W. Bush in 2000, was that you had a tremendous variety of aesthetic style, and suddenly you had the filmmakers putting their own voice in the films rather than the voice of the corporate sponsor, and that was really invigorating. So it's a kind of a golden age now, but by and large, the only bad news is that in recent days, not as many documentaries, theatrically anyway, have been making as much money as they had been, say, 4 or 5 years ago. But creatively, I think we're in a golden age.
One of the things that when I watch your films, and all documentaries, but yours especially, Alex, is the creative use of music throughout your films. I mean, you draw from a number of genres. How much time goes into selecting the music that's the background to your films?
A lot. I mean, it's one of the really fun things about my job is I just sit and listen to song after song after song, and usually for two purposes. One is very often the music speaks for me. It's kind of a toe tapping Greek chorus, lending a sort of ironic commentary to the proceedings. But often the music too is tied to particular characters, which is more traditional. But trying to find the right song for the right character is really fun. And for a long time, I was looking like what songs would be right for Jack Abramoff. And I, you know, I found the old blues man Howlin' Wolf, who sings "Spoonful" and "Backdoor Man." It seemed, you know, for a white Jewish kid from Beverly Hills, that seemed very funny to me. But it nevertheless had that kind of darker side that was sort of fun to play with. And we had a very hot rap tune that stood for Tom DeLay, you know, at his height, when he was walking with great swagger. Another, of course, very white guy, but nevertheless, that kind of gangster rap had a kind of vibe about Tom DeLay, sort of like, there are no rules here, and watch out, MF.
Our guest, Alex Gibney, you've just been listening to the documentary filmmaker, just made the brand new film, Casino Jack, in the United States of Money. It's just been released and distributed by Magnolia Pictures. Alex, let's get back to the film. Some of the material in here is disturbing, to put it mildly. about Abramoff and what this money actually pays for, the results of the corruption, I guess you could say. Because, I mean, and I think that's something I'd like to talk about a bit later in the show, which is that there's a cost we pay as a society when we have corrupt policies being made and when government policies are being bought. And one of the major segments in the documentary is about the Marianas Islands in the 1990s. And could you just talk a little bit about, you know, where that fits into the Abramoff story and why that's in the film?
Well, Jack Abramoff was a master at finding oddball clients who had a desperate need for help in Washington and sometimes rather unlimited pocketbooks. One of his clients were the Marianas Islands in the Pacific. It's a commonwealth of the United States, and they had a very interesting policy, which was that they were allowed to set a much lower minimum wage and have very loose immigration and labor rules in order to be able to attract very low-cost labor from China and the Philippines and South Asia. But the factory owners there ruthlessly abused this, so much so that they had basically created kind of virtual slave society in which these people were sometimes literally chained to their sewing machines, making goods on which could be put the label "Made in the USA." So it was a horrible scam. But when Congress threatened to shut it down, who moves in but Jack Abramoff? And they hire Jack Abramoff to work things out with who? His good close friend, Tom DeLay, who could shut down any attempt to shut down the Marianas in Congress. And so it was a great protection racket, but it was protecting the most appalling kind of labor abuses you could possibly imagine. There's one congressman from California who goes out there and actually hired a translator. Imagine that, to speak to people in their native tongue. And one person came up to him and said, "Congressman, could I sell you my kidney so that I could go home to China?" You know, that's how bad it was. So you know, what Abramoff did was pretty appalling, and it was policy that couldn't be undone because of the lock on power that Tom DeLay had and the lock on the money that Jack Abramoff had. And it's an example of just how wrong things can go when you have this system of campaign finance, which basically puts our congresspeople and senators up for sale.
And what's happening in the Marianas today? What's the state of the situation?
Well, you know, I have to be honest and say it's not a good situation. The rules and regulations are back, but there's no good solution for their economic problem, which is how to solve, how to bring a vibrant economy to that commonwealth. But you know, erecting a slave society was not the solution.
Our guest is Alex Gibney. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment to Media Matters, the number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And as a result, Alex, of the scandal surrounding Jack Abramoff, he obviously went to prison. He's still in prison, isn't he?
Yeah, he's about to be released to a halfway house, I believe, somewhere near the Washington, D.C. area. He spent almost 4 years in prison. His partner in crime, Mike Scanlon, has been out pending sentencing, and I guess he's waiting to see if anything good as far as he goes is going to happen with the Supreme Court on this honest services fraud decision, which may have a big impact for a lot of white collar criminals.
Well, what is that? I think your listeners might not be familiar with what you're talking about. What is this decision at the Supreme Court?
There's a decision to be made, I believe, this month on honest services fraud. Honest services fraud is a statute which, I admit, is somewhat vague and has been a very useful tool for prosecutors to go after people who, and the term, and I may get this wrong, is that basically you're depriving somebody of your honest services. That is to say, if they expect you to behave in a certain way and you're intentionally not doing that, you can be convicted of fraud. The statute is probably too broad, and nevertheless, it's been a very useful tool in Enron and other cases in terms of bringing outrageous fraud to light.
And so if the Supreme Court rules that out, it undermines the ability to convict some white-collar criminals.
Correct, okay. Correct.
But it does offhand. I mean, given the crimes that Scanlon and Abramoff commit that are documented in the film and documented in court, it seems fairly ridiculous that this guy's getting out in 4 years.
I guess so. I mean, you know, it's a tricky thing. The way the statutes are written, actually, is that, and you have to remember that Jack Abramoff pled guilty, and very often you get a lower sentence if you plead guilty mm-hmm. in exchange for cooperation, and he cooperated a lot with federal prosecutors. I'm a little mystified, as is Abramoff, that more people weren't indicted than have been to date. You know, there have been a number of other more minor federal officials who were indicted, but no other congresspeople or senators.
And how much is this, when he gets out and when Scanlon's no one's looking, have these guys probably salted away a couple hundred million in the Bahamas or the Caymans or someplace?
Well, the interesting thing about Jack Abramoff is that, first of all, he owes the Indian tribes that he allegedly defrauded something like $20 million. So he's got a big hole in his pocket, even if he did stash money away. But I think the odd and interesting thing about Abramoff was that he gave away a lot of his money. A lot of his money was funneled into a Jewish boys' school called the Eshkol Academy, just outside of Washington, D.C. And also he blew a lot of his dough on a restaurant called Signatures, where he comped so many congresspeople and senators that it was always running in the red. So I'm not sure how much money Jack has when he gets out, though I would suspect that some of his ex-business partners are probably holding something for him. Mike Scanlon, on the other hand, who I think is, you know, Jack Abramoff is a zealot. Mike Scanlon, his partner, was more of a common criminal, in my view. He salted away a lot of dough and put it into real estate, and even though real estate values have gone down, Scanlon's holdings are pretty big, though he also has to pay many millions of dollars back to the Indian tribes.
Alex Gibney, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking about his brand-new documentary, Casino Jack in the United States of Money. Alex Gibney, the Oscar-winning filmmaker for his film Taxi to the Dark Side that came out in 2007, won the award in 2008. And for this film, Alex, you actually had extensive interviews, as I understand it, with Jack Abramoff, although you couldn't put him on camera. Is that right?
Yeah, I visited him in prison, but the Department of Justice forced Jack to knuckle under. He had agreed to be interviewed on camera, and then the Department of Justice moved in and made his life very miserable and basically said, you know, watch out. If you do the interview, we're going to make your life miserable, which right now there's a Freedom of Information Act request by Melanie Sloan's group in Washington, CREW, to try to get all the documentation of the heavy-handed things that the Department of Justice did to keep Abramoff from talking.
Why wouldn't the Department of Justice want Abramoff to talk? I mean, is this the Obama Department of Justice or the Bush?
Started out with Bush and it continued into the Obama administration. And I suspect that there's probably a technical reason, which is there's an ongoing federal investigation, and they only want one version of the truth, which is their version of the truth. That is to say, the testimony that Jack Abramoff has given to them. Now, he hasn't testified on the stand, but they don't want him giving other versions that might not be as neatly sculpted by them to people like me. I think that's a shame because, you know, Jack Abramoff has been sentenced, and there's a lot that he could tell us about how corruption works in the nation's capital. So I think what the Department of Justice is doing is just dead wrong.
Is Abramoff, in your view, from your conversations with him, contrite? Is he... You know, I get a sense from Bob Ney, the congressman from Ohio, who actually did time as a result of the Abramoff scandal, that, you know, he's really revisited his whole thinking about public life as a result of this.
He has, and actually, you know, as a very idealistic Republican, when he first came to Congress, you know, Ney has, you know, who also was a believer in the virtues of an unfettered free market, he's come around to the view that only some form of public financing can save American democracy. And Bob was very candid in terms of speaking about his role. I think he and his former chief of staff, Neil Volz, were also in the film, really give people an insight into how this stuff works. Abramoff, I think, is contrite. It's hard to know. I mean, to some extent, he may have been telling me, you know, what I wanted to hear, but I think he is contrite and believes the whole lobbying business is deeply corrupt. Nevertheless, he still maintains that dyed-in-the-wool conservative view that the only solution for government is, in the words of his old friend Grover Norquist, to make it so small that you could take it into the bathroom and drought it in the bathtub.
and make a few hundred million dollars along the way.
Right.
Our guest, Alex Gibney. Again, the phone number here at WILL is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. If you want to call in with any questions or comments, this is a live program of Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Alex Gibney, when you made the film, one of the things that struck me were the number of interviews you were able to get with people who might not have had a great interest in talking about this publicly. You managed to get them on camera and on screen. I'm thinking of Tom DeLay, Dana Rohrabacher. Was it difficult to get these people?
With enough money for bribes, anything is possible.
Well, I know you got that fat wallet now, Alex.
It was hard. And it took a long time to make this film because it was hard to get some of these people on the record. But, I just keep at it. I keep going at these people, writing letters, going to people who may know them, who may intercede on my behalf until finally they agree to talk. And when they do agree to talk, very often it's the old journalist adage. It's not hard. Once they sit down to talk with you, it's not hard getting people to talk. It's getting them to shut up. It's
Were there people you wanted to get on camera other than Abramoff himself who refused and you simply couldn't get them to budge?
Yeah. Mike Scanlon, who was, of course, I understand, he hadn't been sentenced yet, so legally that was a bit of a problem for him. And John McCain. John McCain would never talk to me, which I found hypocritical in the sense that he was the guy who had, run this big investigation through the Indian Affairs Committee against Abramoff. But there were a lot of tricky aspects to that investigation, and I wanted to explore those, but McCain would never talk to me.
Yeah, I want to follow up on the McCain issue in a second, but probably for background, one of the major themes in the film is talking about the Indian gambling issue and Abramoff's outsized role in representing those interests, some of them selectively, but very aggressively in Washington. Can you just give a little bit of background on that and what role that plays in the whole story?
Sure. I mean, a lot of Native American tribes have the right to run casinos on their property, and that can be a very, very, very lucrative business. And so they have a lot of cash, and they have a lot of very direct financial interests, either in terms of tax policy or in terms of trying to prevent other casinos from opening nearby. That's not a national issue, but very often Abramoff would use his clout to pick and choose among tribes, depending on who he is representing. So they have a very strong interest. They have a lot of money, which means that in this system of pay-to-play, they can have a lot of influence. And Abramoff was the key go-to guy in Indian country because he did deliver for his clients on a number of early cases, though very often part of his genius was taking credit for things that he and others were doing. But nevertheless, he convinced a lot of tribes that he had unique access to the top of the Republican Party and that he was good at what he did and that he cared about who they were. So a lot of them hired him for fantastic amounts of money. I mean, he was charging just astronomical amounts. And that's why, ultimately, I think he was brought down in part because of dissident Native Americans who were pissed off and moved against him, and also because of rival lobbyists who were angry that he was making so much money and getting so many clients, and they weren't.
That comes through in the film, both those points, and I thought it was very good reporting on your part to do that. Let's go to the phone lines now for some callers who want to speak with Alex Gibney, our guest today in Media Matters. Gibney, again, has got the new film out that he's just made, Casino Jack in the United States of Money. Let's start with line one. Urbana, you're on the air with Alex Gibney.
Thank you very much for the film, and I have a question. As an economist, it seems to me that now all one has to do is give to the right people, and you can start up a firm like Blackwater or something that will work for Halliburton, whose previous CEO became vice president, and it seems to me that that's the way the country is run now. What Jack Abramoff started has now become sort of policy.
I agree with the caller. I think that this is the biggest problem. If you look at the so-called financial reforms that are slowly moving their way through the House and Senate now, you know, they're so pallid. They're so lame, considering, you know, how close we were brought to the brink of disaster. And why are they so pallid and so lame? Because the financial firms are spending millions and millions of dollars and showering that money on congresspeople and senators. And so the popular will, which I think is to get tough with Wall Street, I don't think there's much doubt about that, is being subverted by cash. It's just pay to play. It's really an outrageous system that we've invented. And it's becoming worse and worse every year because the cost of elections are going up so much. And truth be told, you know, actually, in many ways, the congresspeople and senators in Washington don't like it all that much either, but they won't stop it.
Yeah, you make a point.
They spend 2 to 3 days out of every working week raising money. We're paying Congress to raise money. It's really outrageous when you think about it.
Yeah, you make the point in the film. You have the expert on the screen who talks about how much of their waking hours members of Congress, even when they're not actively running for re-election or campaign, have to spend still, you know, raising money. It's a permanent part of the job, a significant part of it.
A third to a half of every week is spent raising money. It's just insane.
I have a friend who's in the United States Senate, who's been there for a while, who's been a guest in this program, and he told me when he was running for office about his when he first ran for Senate, how much time he had to spend making phone calls to
right.
wealthy people, and it was basically his entire job. In effect, I mean, he squeezed a speech or doing some actual work around his phone calling schedule, and he said that's just standard. You know, that's what they all do. That's the job now. It is extraordinary.
Well, and one of the things that one of the byproducts of that is that. You have a situation where you're so desperate to raise money that you end up raising money from some rather unsavory characters. And that's where actually a lot of Democrats, in addition to Republicans, got tarred with the Abramoff brush because they were so desperate for Abramoff's cash that they didn't really look too carefully about how or why they were being given that money. And they can't really afford to. So, you know, we've got a situation where some pretty unsavory characters are giving money to our congresspeople and senators. And they can't help themselves because they just need to raise that money in order to get reelected.
You know, the obvious question, Alex Gibney, then is, given this problem you just outlined, the movie makes crystal clear, is it possible to even have reform come out of the people? Even if they don't like it, they're so caught up in the system, they need the money to survive.
Well, it is a tremendous problem. I mean, there is a bill sponsored by Dick Durbin that I hope will be at least a first step to addressing this problem. It sets campaign contribution limits way low, and if you accept those limits, then you're eligible for huge federal matches. That might help. Anything at this stage could help. But the biggest problem is that none of these people in Congress or the Senate are going to pay attention until they start getting bounced from office by angry voters. Now, you know, I'm not a big fan of the Tea Party movement, but the anti-incumbent movement may have some impact on this. But I fear that because it's too mindless at the moment, it's not going to have the real impact that it should have. But God knows it would help for a bunch of people who have been, you know, feeding at the trough for a long time to get tossed out of Congress to begin to slowly upset this situation.
You know, when I thought about the Tea Party movement as I watched your film, Alex, to some extent because of the sort of ideological purity of the young Ralph Reed and Jack Abramoff, and then the complete corruption with which they manipulated people who still might have had ideological purity later on and cashed in on it. Because about 2 months ago, Glenn Beck, who's sort of become one of the leaders, so to speak, or self-appointed leaders of the Tea Party movement, was at a town meeting he had arranged in Florida, and it was carried on Fox News, and I watched part of it. And what was stunning to me as I watched it was that one of his cherry-picked members of the Tea Party from Florida stood up and said, I think the biggest problem in American politics is all the money, all the corporate money and all the private interest money that dominates our politics, and that's really the biggest problem. And he said it emphatically, and Glenn Beck's response was, because that's not Glenn Beck's position, was say, no, the problem is term limits. We need term limits. And the person said, no, he repeated it. But Glenn Beck went on and on and then finally cut the guy off and they went to another subject. But it sort of highlighted, I think, the point you're getting at, that within the Tea Party, there are these people who really understand the corruption, but the leadership doesn't want to go that direction at all, as far as I can tell.
Because the leadership is getting the money. I mean, you know, you look at somebody like Mitch McConnell, you know, who's Mr. Free Enterprise. But then suddenly when something comes along like the BP disaster, which is just a cataclysm, he wants to set limits on how much BP would have to pay. Well, what kind of free enterprise is that? I thought it was risk and reward.
No, it's just reward.
That's right.
That's what your movie establishes.
Tails, I win, tails you lose.
That's right. Our guest today is Alex Gibney, who's made the new film Casino Jack in the United States of Money. Let's go back to the phone lines to another caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Alex Gibney.
Hi, yeah, the crony capitalism that we have is so endemic that I think one should mention the Obama campaign and how implicated it was, with Penny Pritzker being the rainmaker for his campaign fundraising, and her family fortune is involved in crafting the subprimes, one of the early innovators, these capitalist innovations that we have. But I actually had a question about the movie as well, but the other point was Goldman Sachs, of course, was the biggest single financial donor to the Obama campaign of that kind of corporate phenomenon. But vis-a-vis the film, since Abramoff was a film producer for a while in his zealousness, he actually helped with this absolutely horrible film that was sort of an apology for Jonas Savimbi and the apartheid.
That's all in the documentary, I might add.
Wondering if he got permission to use, or was it a fair use kind of excerpt?
It was a fair use kind of thing. It's in the film, and so is his Abramoff's documentary production, where he hosted a kind of right-wing Woodstock in Angola, hosted, in fact, by Jonas Savimbi, where he invited the Contras and the Mujahideen, and they went around shooting machine guns in the air. Then he recast it as a feature film, an action film with Dolph Lundgren called Red Scorpion. And we have a few clips from that film in the movie. There's a nice personal touch from Jack Abramoff. In high school, he was a weightlifter. He could power squat, I think, over 500 pounds. And there's a weightlifting action sequence in the film. It's the only one, so far as I'm aware, that's ever been produced.
He did a cameo, I take it.
Huh?
Abramoff did a cameo in
it? No. He cast Dolph Lundgren as the weightlifter. Dolph Lundgren lifts a Jeep out of a ditch. In a power squat move that Jack Abramoff, I think, would have been proud of. But it was impressive to see a weightlifting action sequence.
Well, actually, Alex, if I can just interject here, also, I think the clips you showed of Red Scorpion demonstrated that this is a film that's clearly going to go for cult status at some point based on Dolph Lundgren's acting in it.
Right on, right there with Plan 9 from Outer Space, I think, and Ed Wood. Or Ed Wood's oeuvre. Ed Wood, the Tim Burton film, is quite a good film.
It is. A caller from line 2, do you have some more you'd like to say or a question? Oh, I think we've lost caller from line 2. Sorry about that. Didn't mean to hang up on you. Thank you for calling. If anyone would like to call in, we still have time for more callers here at WILL, the number 333-9455, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. I'd like to talk a little bit more about some of the contemporary issues we were just talking about. And one of the things that comes through in your movie, again, is this term libertarian, which we hear all the time. But it seems like this libertarianism that we always hear about in Washington and that the Tea Party sometimes claims to be, or Rand Paul, it sort of ends at corporate power. It's a Tea Party that only covers part of the waterfront.
I agree with that. I think that's a very good point, Bob, because actually I think the libertarians have some really good points to make about government power and how it should be limited. But they seem to check out all their cynicism and all their critical faculties when it comes to corporate power, as if BP has our best interests at heart, or Merck in the production of Vioxx had our best interests at heart, or Goldman Sachs had our best interests at heart. They don't. They exist for one purpose and one purpose only, which is to make money for their shareholders. Understandable. But that doesn't mean that they're working in our interest. It's really interesting. It would be very interesting to see what kind of consumer protection bill comes out of the recent financial reforms, because the investment banks are trying very hard to limit those and to water them down as much as possible. And indeed, already I think 98% of the nation's banks are going to be exempt from this Consumer Protection Agency. It's and yet, what could be more basic in terms of a benefit to the consumer? That is to say, most of us. But it doesn't happen because the money is just too great. So yeah, on this libertarian issue, it's a mystery to me why the libertarians are so Pollyanna-ish about corporate power when they're so rightly cynical about government power.
Alex Gibney, the film depends to no small extent on the journalism and the reporters have done at the Washington Post and elsewhere. How much of the film is based on work other journalists did, and how much is work that you and your team did and came up with?
Well, I think it's always a mix. You know, there are some people that we got that nobody else had spoken to. Bob Ney would be one. Neil Volz would be another. And the Post never went out to the Marianas, which we did. And we uncovered all sorts of artifacts and photographs, you know, sort of proving Abramoff's links to the Bush administration and things like that. We found the lifeguard who had been hired by Abramoff to be the head of this phony think tank through which he funneled so much money from the government of Malaysia and money for Ralph Reed. But at the same time, I give due to a lot of great print reporters who did a lot of great work. Sue Schmidt and her team at the Washington Post, also a watchdog group called Crew out of Washington, which is led by Melanie Sloan, and a wonderful reporter, actually a local reporter in Louisiana. So, you know, in a lot of my films, I try to credit the print journalists who've done such a good job of digging out stories like this. You know, very often programs like 60 Minutes don't do that. They cherry pick their stories, but they never mention them for fear of seeming weak. I think it's a strength to mention the good work that's been done by some of these great investigative journalists.
Are you concerned with the sort of decline in the number of working journalists across the board in the United States in the last, well, it's been going on for a couple of decades, but it's accelerated in the last, say, 3 years, that there aren't going to be the Sue Schmidts around covering these stories or doing, or the guy down in Louisiana more likely even to break the stories that you sort of need as your bread and butter to base your work on?
Yeah, or for any of us to base our work on. I mean, you know, the fact is that for any of us to be informed. Sue Schmidt no longer works for the Washington Post. She went to the Journal and now works for a private investigative firm. The local reporter from Louisiana is out of a job. You know, who's going to pay for investigative journalists to spend 6 months on a single story, which is sometimes what you have to do to dig out the stuff? It's a very different discipline than writing a blog. And it requires investment in that person's time. So, yeah, I am concerned. You know, right now I'm lucky. You know, I can spend 2 or 3 years on a film, sometimes because I do 2 or 3 at the same time. But you know, how much longer that's going to last, I don't know. And that's the thing I'm most concerned about is who's going to fund the investigative reporters.
Our guest is Alex Gibney. We've got a full bank of callers. I want to get to all of them before the show ends. Let's start right now. Line 4, LaSalle, Illinois. You're on the air.
Thank you. I love your show. I hate it when I miss it. I have a question about the ex-presidents and the money they get. I mean, I remember when Ronald Reagan went to Japan, and he got paid $2 million for basically doing nothing. And Clinton's getting rich, and what's George Bush doing these days? And money in government and my question revolves around, are they getting paid off when they leave, and how are they getting all the... I hear Clinton has $100 million now, and how much money did Reagan die with, and how much money do these guys have? And that. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, caller. Alex?
I don't know. I mean, this is not an area of my expertise, but I have to tell you that in some ways, I'm not that unsympathetic to former presidents who go on the lecture circuit. I mean, they get a lot of dough. But they're no longer involved in policy. So long as they're not involved in policy and their bread isn't being buttered by people who are going to affect our daily lives, I'm not as interested in whether they get paid well or not. To me, the bigger danger is people who are being greased while they are our public representatives. That's a much bigger problem in my view.
Let's go now to line one, Champagne. You're on the air with Alex Gibney.
Yeah, good morning or afternoon. Hey, could you unpack a little bit what you said about the, what was the name of the islands where the slave labor was?
Marianas Islands.
Marianas, right. And you said that Tom DeLay was able to stop any regulation. Could you just unpack for me a little bit exactly how that worked, what the mechanisms are, and why exactly is it that nobody thinks they'll get elected again?
Well, I think in the case of the Marianas, a congressman from California named George Miller kept bringing up possible legislation to stop the abuses in the Marianas.
And these are a U.S. protectorate, just so that's why it's covered by Congress.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a commonwealth, and they have one representative, I believe an informal representative, in Congress. But Tom DeLay never permitted it through the rules of the House to come out of committee. So he controlled the votes of the committees rather ruthlessly. And so the bills would always die before they came up for a vote on the floor through all sorts of procedural mechanisms. That's how basically they did it. And Tom DeLay was only too happy to do it because he was getting paid a lot of money for doing this thing, sometimes by the factory owners directly.
Let's now go to line two, St. Francisville. You're on the air with Alex Gibney.
Yes, hello. I came in on your program late, so forgive me if someone's already asked this, but there was a murder of a casino owner, one of the casino ships that goes like out past the international limit, where they don't have to pay taxes on that on their winnings. And that was either in Florida or South Carolina. And the story goes, ironically, he somebody came up, shot him at a red light in his vehicle. And his vehicle came to rest either near the gambling boat or something like that that he owned. And supposedly he was killed because he wouldn't sell this boat to people that were supposedly involved with Abramoff, some of his associates. Could you comment on that and if anyone's ever been arrested for that murder? Thank you.
Sure. That's an incident that it actually opens the film. The man you're referring to is a guy named Gus Bulis, who had run a floating casino business called Sun Cruise, and Jack Abramoff and his pal Adam Kadan bought Sun Cruise from Gus Bulis, and when Gus Bulis tried to maintain influence in the firm, there were some rather acrimonious dealings between everybody, and next thing everybody knew, Gus Bulis was dead, killed in a mob style hit. To date, the people accused of that murder, former mobsters in the Gambino family, have not been brought to trial, though I'm told that's going to happen soon. One of the problems, apparently, is that one of the killers, or alleged killers, was an FBI informant. I don't think Abramoff had anything to do with the murder, but we put the episode in to show this problem, which is that Abramoff suddenly was associating himself with some rather unsavory characters, and those unsavory characters, by virtue of Abramoff, were right next to Tom DeLay, in effect. And so that's how this kind of influence peddling works, where suddenly our members of Congress are all too close to people in, say, organized crime, for example.
Alex Gibney, our guest, we're talking about his new film, Casino Jack in the United States of Money, just released. Gibney, of course, the Oscar-winning film director who's been on the show before, discussing his other work, including Taxi to the Dark Side. Alex, this is an Alex Gibney Films, it's called, the subheading, but making a motion picture is a huge industrial undertaking. How big is the team that you had to assemble to make this film?
It's at its core, it's quite small. Four or five people, but it ultimately involves maybe 50, from the cinematographers, the sound people, the researchers, the final post-production people. So it's a really pretty small group of dedicated folks. But then we hire on board a lot of pretty talented people to do this or that. Sometimes even journalists or researchers, and sometimes a lot of production people in order to get certain things done.
I noticed that on the credits for this film, as with the Gonzo, your film on Hunter Thompson, and I'm not sure about other films you've done, that one of the people involved with it is Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks basketball team in the NBA. And Cuban has a wide range of investments. Is he, to your knowledge, is this an investment for him, or is this something he just believes in documentary films? What's his connection to your work?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, he owns Magnolia Pictures, and Magnolia is, or he and Todd Wagner, his partner, own Magnolia Pictures. And Magnolia Pictures has distributed a number of my films, and Magnolia was one of the two investors in this film, along with Participant, and Participant, you know, was famous for its investment in Inconvenient Truth and a number of other Hollywood films. So they, you know, Cuban and Wagner have this distribution company, Magnolia, that has handled a lot of my films in the past and in the future. They're going to be handling my film on Elliot Spitzer.
Yeah, we only have a couple of minutes left. If you wouldn't mind, what is on the horizon for you? Let's start with Elliot Spitzer.
Well, there's a film called Client 9, The Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer, and it looks at his rise and fall. And it's a very surprising film in that you discover that the story is really nothing like what you've been led to believe in the mainstream media. So, you know, it's kind of a mystery story in that way. And then I'm also working on a film on Lance Armstrong, and percolating some other projects. And a film I'd done with Lawrence Wright, the author of The Looming Tower, will be on HBO in the fall called My Trip to Al-Qaeda, a sort of a first-person look at going to the heart of terror.
You know, Alex, what media do you consume to sort of stay on top of the world? What do you consider the must-reading or viewing or consuming to sort of be a citizen of the world and actually to do your job well?
That's hard to say. I mean, you know, I surf the web. I love, depending on what story I'm working on, I usually key into a few key blogs. You know, I read the Times and the Wall Street Journal every day, and also blogs like Talking Points Memo. There's sometimes one called Naked Capitalism. And then, you know, people tip me about this, that, or the other thing, and then, you know, you dig in. But it's hard. It's hard for all of us because it's hard but also inspiring because the information is so diffuse now. And that's, I think, a good thing, but it makes it tougher to follow.
What are some of the documentaries, Alex Gibney, you've seen in the last couple of years that you've really liked, that you don't think have gotten the attention they deserve, that if you had a chance to sort of promote them or mention them to our audience, you would mention?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I guess the ones I like did get attention. There was one I love called Waltz with Bashir, mm-hmm. which was actually an animated documentary, with the exception of one small piece of real footage at the end, all about the Sabra Shatila massacre in Lebanon, a very, very powerful film. I loved this film, Man on Wire, mm-hmm. That came out a few years ago. And I don't know, those are two that come to mind.
And then finally, in our last question, I want to ask you about Michael Moore and what role he has played in popularizing documentary filmmaking, in your view.
I think he's played a tremendous role in the sense that aware of the fact that, you know, it is possible to make money with these films, and it is possible to be very, very, very popular. That's a good thing. So, you know, whether you like Michael's films, I think you have to appreciate the fact that he's done a tremendous job in terms of popularizing the form, which is a great thing.
Well, if people want to learn more about Casino Jack, short of actually going to the theater to see it, to learn a little bit more, Alex, is there a website they can go to?
Sure. There's a Magnolia Pictures website. Just Google Magnolia Pictures. And then also there is an informed website about some of these issues called takepart.org. And then you can go onto a website there called Follow the Money, you know, once you're inside that URL, that'll show you exactly how and where the money flows, and will take you also directly to your congresspeople on Saturdays.
Alex Gibney, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. Thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters, and good luck with your work, Alex.
Many thanks, Bob. Always a pleasure to be on
okay.
your show.
Okay. And I want to thank Melissa Trentz, my producer, Kyle Kroha, the engineer, for their great work. I'm Bob McChesney, back in 167 hours with Stephen Kinzer, talking about his new book on the Middle East, Iran, and Turkey in the United States. Until then, everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Here's the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana. We'll have mostly sunny skies today, and there's a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon, the high 75. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low of 58. Monday, mostly sunny with a high of 70.